facing the problem of deindustrialization, even without globalization, just because of the nature of technological progress. Globalization has made the problem worse, but the strains in our society would be present even without globalization.
Coming up on In Contrast, Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He is formerly both the chief economist at the World Bank and chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. A professor at Columbia University, he is the author of several books, including Globalization and Its Discontents, which was originally released in 2002 and updated and revised in 2017. Professor Joseph Stiglitz, it's a pleasure to have you in Contrast.
Nice to be here.
I want to start with your views on Trump, his policies on tariffs, the approach that he and other world leaders have currently as populists against globalization. This in many ways represents steps back from what was achieved during the previous administrations, but also you have been critical of what previous administrations have done in this area.
So it puts me in a very awkward position because I've criticized globalization, he's criticized it, but we are 180 degrees apart. And it's often difficult to explain how we criticize globalization from such diametrically opposed perspectives. So I believe very strongly that you need a rule of law. Within a country, we could not function without a rule of law. And the same thing as we become more integrated into a global economy, you need rules. In the absence of rules, a rule of law, you have a jungle, and the most powerful prevails, and the fact that there is a jungle out there really inhibits productive interaction. The point I've had for a very long time is that the particular rules we have favor the advanced countries against the poor and developing countries and emerging markets. I wrote the book Globalization and Its Discontents after having spent more than 3 years as chief economist of the World Bank and seeing firsthand how globalization was playing out to their disadvantage. Now, Trump has said the rules of the game are unfair to the United States. The idea that the rules would be unfair to the United States, in a way, is absurd because we wrote the rules. You know, I've watched the rulemaking process over a very long time, and there is the appearance of a negotiation, but the reality is what the U.S. wants is what is reflected in the agreement, you know, 99.9%. The problem was that what we wanted reflected the interests of our corporations. So what is true is the trade agreements are unfair to workers, both in the United States and in the developing countries.
And you have also, throughout your career, been critical of those of governance within those institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, because they are the ones that establish those rules, as you said, and they are biased to the corporations or the 1%. Is there any sense at any point that those that are in the governance could limit or restrict themselves? What's the logic of thinking that those that have power would want to cede power, that they would restrain, that they would sacrifice, that they would see the benefit of the global community, those developing countries, as equal or maybe superior to them for the immediate future, and instead give up their self-interest?
That's a very good question. I think that there is an interest in all countries should be an interest in having a rule of law that is fairer, having a system of better governance. The reason is that as we try to cooperate together in a world of globalization, that cooperation needs the support of citizens in all the countries. You're not going to get that kind of cooperation if the system of governance is viewed to be fundamentally unfair. We, I think, gain a great deal by participating in globalization, but so do the developing countries. If we can make sure the rules work well for everybody, and if there's not good governance and legitimacy, people won't trust that the laws are done in a way that is beneficial to all.
And how do we achieve that? How do we seek the participation of those that are developing or those that don't have that much power at an equal level, thus giving legitimacy and objectivity to that kind of governance? Is it by inviting them into the table at an equal level, or will it always be a mirage? We want to give others some credit, but in fact, it is just a pretense.
One way of thinking about this is to recognize that we, I'd say United States, Western Europe, the countries that have been dominant in globalization, are democracies, you know, imperfect democracies, but democracies. And within our democracies, and this is especially true in Western Europe, there are strong civil society groups that are concerned about social justice, that are concerned about developing countries. I don't know whether in Western Europe it's a feeling of guilt as a result of colonialism or the sense of social justice arising out of Christian traditions. But what I can say is that there are very strong groups like Oxfam, Christian Aid, Save the Children, that are very influential, particularly in the international arena. Unfortunately, in the United States, the international arena is left to too large extent to the corporations. But in the rest of the world, as I say, there is a greater balance in the voices that are heard. The result of this is that, for instance, in the G20 meetings following the global financial crisis, there was an agreement among the G20 that going forward, the president of the World Bank and the head of the IMF would be chosen on merit. Now, you might say that doesn't seem like a very radical proposal, that in the 21st century you have merit-based appointments of the heads of an institution. But in the past, the head of the IMF was always a European, and the head of the World Bank was always an American, and it was basically the president of the United States that had that appointment within his purview. They said that system was going to discontinue. Unfortunately, when the moment of truth came, President Obama said, well, that was what we said at that meeting, but we really didn't mean it. And the two developing country people had been nominated for the head of the World Bank, Jose Antonio Ocampo from Colombia, and a very distinguished Nigerian. I knew both of them well. They were eminently qualified to be president of the World Bank. But the United States wanted an American, and what the United States wanted was what happened. But I think going forward, there is eventually, we're living in the 21st century, and as Prime Minister Trudeau said when asked why 50% of his cabinet were women, he said, it's the 21st century. And my feeling is, why will the head of the World Bank and the IMF eventually not be allocated in the way that it's been in the past? And I say, it's the 21st century.
You began by explaining the different viewpoints on globalization. But I want to be more granular now, concentrating in one or two regions in particular, and see what you think is the impact of the policies that he's having. Particularly, for instance, we could begin with China, where the tariffs that he is imposing have generated literally a war between the two. What is the outcome, in your view, of the strategies that Trump is having with the use of tariffs to China?
I think what Trump has done is going to alter fundamentally the nature of globalization for a long time to come. I should add that what he is doing perhaps accelerated some issues with globalization, but they would have eventually been raised anyway. On the one hand, what he is emphasizing unintentionally is that borders matter. Since World War II, there's been a lot of effort to try to make borders less important. And nation state is still the basic unit, the political unit in the world. But there's been efforts to make sure that goods and services, capital, flow more freely across borders on the grounds that that will lead to greater prosperity. And I think there's some evidence that that is the case. But the way globalization was structured and managed at the same time resulted in big losers and big winners. And so even if the global pie was increased, there were some people who were actually significantly hurt by globalization. And the failure was within the United States and within certain European countries. They didn't address those who were being hurt by globalization. And that has hurt the credibility of the advocates of globalization. So going forward, I think that globalization will not have the kind of mantra with which it was surrounded, which was the inevitable future. It will be more of a subject to debate. The second point I'd raise is that in the aftermath of the fall of the Iron Curtain, there was a famous book written by Fukuyama called The End of History. And there was a belief that the world would be converging towards liberal democracy and that trade was an important element in that process of convergence. What is happening now is a questioning of that move towards liberal democracy, both in the West and outside the West. Mm-hmm. When I say that, clearly what's happened in Hungary and in Poland and Turkey and some people think in the United States is putting to question our commitment to liberal democracy. And the same thing is true in China, that China is, with President Xi being given the possibility of remaining president for life, the question is, are they moving in the direction that many people thought they would be moving and which greater economic integration would be an important part of the process by which they would move there?
Instead of this globalism that we have had in the last 30 years, you talk about a big questioning that is taking place and even the shaking of liberal democracies on both sides. Is there a way that I could push you to be more concrete by telling me what is replacing the vision that we have on globalism? Or is it globalism with a distinct taste and flavor that we are entering now, where borders are stricter, where the movement of labor is more controlled and capital? Is this still the taste of globalism as we knew it and know it? Or do you believe we're entering a period in which, as a result of all these policies and with the emergence of these populist figures in strategic places on both sides, the very concept is being shaken?
Well, clearly it is being shaken. Let me begin by saying that the position of Trump and other people, nativist, their argument is fundamentally flawed. And that's in the sense that they are blaming globalization for the ills of society. What they are really doing is trying to blame others, whether it's migrants, foreign trade, for the problems in our own society. And I believe very strongly that it's not migrants that are causing the problems in the United States. To a large extent, it's not even globalization. We would be facing a problem of deindustrialization, even without globalization, just because of the nature of technological progress. Globalization has made the problem worse, but the strains in our society would be present even without globalization. But it's so easy to blame others for one's own failures. What we should have done was to have the kind of active labor market policy, systems of social protection that would have helped those in the old economy move to the new. The irony is that those on the right, including the advocates of globalization, were the very people who opposed the actions that would have protected the people who were hurt. part of the argument I make in my book, Globalization and Discontent Revisited, is that perhaps they wanted it that way. They actually almost celebrated that people were suffering. Now, what do I mean by that? The corporations wanted lower wages. The more unemployment, the more people were in a precarious position, the more they were threatened by foreigners, the easier it was to lower their wages and to lower their working conditions. So the corporations who were driving the globalization agenda also didn't want globalization to be managed well in the way that I would have, and that would have protected the losers. The corporations were the winners, and they wanted to keep their winnings and not help those who were the losers. So, in my answer, the right way of managing globalization would have been to say, okay, if globalization works in the way it's supposed to, it makes the pie, the national pie, bigger, and everyone can get a bigger slice. And we need social protection. We want social protection without protectionism. Protectionism is not the right way to get social protection. And that was our failing, both on the Democrat and Republican side, not to do enough for those who were being displaced. And that is, I think, the great lesson from what has happened over the last quarter century.
In that lesson or that failing that you describe, I could think of two possible explanations for it. One is the fact that we missed an opportunity, that we could have been savvier, better educated, that we could have studied other societies far closer and implement those programs that would have elevated the situation of workers, mothers, immigrants, and others in a way that would have put us in a better place. Another explanation is the crude and shark-like individualism that is at the very heart of the making of this country. And maybe that one sees in a raw and vicious way these days more than one did in the previous two or three decades. I wonder if it would have been possible truly to implement those programs, or there is something intrinsic in the DNA of this society, of this culture, that puts the individual ahead of society, and that government, particularly when it comes from the side of the Republicans in the philosophy that government is evil, that it is the individual that has to achieve his or her own goals, will not implement those programs because it goes against the very nature of that philosophy.
I do not think it's part of American DNA.
And I'm happy
look,
to hear that.
If you look over the history of our country, you see large elements of cooperative behavior where we work together to address our problem. You go back to the raising of barns and homes and homesteads back in agriculture. You look at the rural credit cooperatives. And as we move to the 21st century, we know that we had to fight together to win World War I and World War II. We know that in a modern economy, what makes us strong is research, innovation. And innovation is based on basic research that has been supported by the government. If you go back again to the 19th century, what gave America the edge and what led America to move from agriculture to manufacturing? It was the investment we collectively made in our land-grant universities and our agricultural extension services that led us to have the highest level of agricultural productivity that meant we didn't need 70% of the labor force to produce the food we needed. We needed only 2 or 3%, and that opened up labor to move into manufacturing. So to me, we've always pulled together to solve our problem. When I see our young people, you see that very, very strongly. Now, I think for the last 35, 40 years, the right has been trying to sell another story. They've been trying to sell the story of rugged American individualism. They've been trying to sell this story that government is the problem, not the solution. And when they run the government, like under President Nixon, it was the problem. Let's be clear. Government doesn't always work. But when you look at our successes and successes in other countries, government has always played an important role. And America has done a very good job of mixing together private, for-profit, not-for-profit, cooperative, and government. You know, you ask, what are our most successful institutions in the United States? Where do we dominate in the world? It's actually our universities. 8 of the 10 strongest universities in the world are American, and all of them are either state universities like the University of California, and actually most of them not-for-profit, which are charity, cooperative, Americans getting together voluntarily supporting. And the other two are Cambridge and Oxford, which are, again, based on donations and, again, with state support. The only for-profit universities are things like Trump University, which excels in exploitation. So I think that caricature of American rugged individualism is a myth that has been created by some on the right to enable them to exploit others.
The challenge and even the critique of liberal economies that we are witnessing these days, might we also dare to think that it is not only that, but that the very texture of democracy, the fiber of democracies worldwide, is in question today? You talked earlier on about the importance of those democracies working together. But even within the United States, the very nature of the metabolism, the idiosyncrasy of our democracy is being tested dramatically in ways by this administration, the Trump administration, that way surpass, in my view, those of previous administrations. Do you think that it is also democracy and not only globalism that might acquire a new taste or a new look?
Yeah, I think that is right. I have a new book that I'm finishing now where I talk about why is it the case that our standards of living are so much higher today than they were 250 years ago, when for the previous thousands of years, standards of living have remained constant, and then all of a sudden things started to change dramatically. And there were two basic ideas that occurred around 1750, 1800. The first was science. How do we discover about the rest of the world? And the second is, how do we organize ourselves in terms of politically and economically, notions like democracy, checks and balances, rules of law, and the institutions that we have for ascertaining the truth. And these together is what has brought us the increases in standard of living. Both of those are, I would say, for the first time, under the kind of massive attack. Now, there have always been those who did not believe in science. We had in the United States the Scopes trial, questioning evolution and teaching of evolution. There are always those who've tried to undermine democracy and question the validity of democracy. But what Trump has done has been a concerted onslaught against our institutions and, to me, you know, question the value of higher education, research, most fundamentally question what we mean by truth, an attack on our truth-telling institutions, our research institutions, our educational institutions, our judiciary, and our media, all the ways by which we try to ascertain the truth. The point of my new book is to argue that if we were to let these nefarious forces succeed, it would mean the end of our progress. It would lead us to go backward in terms of our standards of living. So what is at stake at one level is our democracy and our values, but at another level, it's even our basic core standards of living.
I want to switch gears, and I want to see if I can get you to reconnect with your childhood. You are originally from Gary, Indiana. And if I can bring you to look back, can you point to me at the elements of your growing up there that you think ultimately were decisive in making the man that is sitting across this desk and the studio in such eloquent and articulate ways describing the challenges that we face today? What was it in your family and in the town that shaped you?
Yeah, I think it was both my family and what was going on in the town. Gary reflected the history of industrialization in America. It was founded in 1906 as the largest integrated steel plant in the world. It was a company town. When I was growing up, it was the peak. And since then, it has been affected by deindustrialization like so much of the rest of industrial America. I've gone back and visited it, and what you see just breaks your heart. I didn't realize when I was growing up that this was the golden era of capitalism, that it was as good as it got. As a kid, I saw massive inequality, classmates that basically had no spending money. I didn't have very much, but I saw that there were some who really didn't have anything. You looked around and you saw massive racial discrimination, segregation, you know, just gross inequities of all forms, periodic economic downturns, labor strife, you know, all the things that are wrong with the capitalist system. And I became an economist because these things that I had seen as growing up kept gnawing at me. When I was a student at Amherst College, I had intended to be a physicist, a theoretical physicist is what I really wanted to do, you know, to understand the mysteries of the universe. But these problems kept gnawing at me. And into my junior year, I decided that's what I wanted to do with my life. But as I was growing up, everybody's always affected by their family. And I think my family was particularly concerned about problems of social justice. Not only my parents, but my uncle. There was a sense that even the members of our family that did very well, my uncle was very successful, were very pro-union and believed very strongly that if you did well, you had to help those who didn't do so well. And it just had an enormous influence on me. In many ways, even little things, one of the things my father, I remember saying to me, we had a woman that came in and helped my mother once a week, and he always paid her Social Security wages. And I remember him saying, you know, these are the people who need it the most. And it turned out very fortunate because I had learned that lesson. We had help when my kids were growing up, and I always paid the Social Security taxes. And I don't know if you remember the beginning of the Clinton administration, there were a whole slew of appointees that turned out not to have paid their Social Security taxes, and they couldn't get through the appointments process. So I would not have been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors if I had not followed the advice of my parents. As I look at what's happened today with Trump, these questions are not even being asked today. What we thought were good behavior, good citizenship, to the minimum standards to be eligible to become a public servant have gone by the side.
In that vision pro-union that you were talking about in connection to your parents and your uncle, was that the result of the very dynamic in Gary, Indiana? Or was that coming from immigrants that connected with views of Eastern Europe and other places? Did they forge those views and pass them on to you in their interaction with the American experiment? Or is this something that in your family reaches back?
Well, it clearly reached back, but it was a very live set of views where there would be discussions of the political events of the day. Again, I remember a discussion about, you know, most people thought Robert Kennedy and JFK were paragons of liberal. But if you remember, they went after some of the union. They had ambivalent feelings about union. I just remember discussions criticizing them and saying, you know, how important unions were to reflect the interest of workers. Mm. And if there weren't those unions to protect those workers, who would be speaking for them? And, of course, that's a problem we have today.
I want to go to the book Globalization and Its Discontents, revisit it. And I want to ask you a couple of questions connected with it. The book came out in 2002, but this particular edition, the revision that includes a section in the cover, Anti-Globalization in the Era of Trump, just came out in 2018. Before I ask you how you put these two books, the old and the new, together, I want to ask you about something that is very dear to me and that I admire very much in you, and that is the quest to communicate as a writer with an audience that is beyond your discipline. How did you come to be the economist that speaks to a large audience that, as a result, at times becomes the target of those that can attack you for your ideas, but that communication with the large audience seems to me, as one of your readers, intrinsic to the very argument that you're making, and that is that if we live in a world of inequality and if we're going to bring others, it is also about dispersing the knowledge all across and not only in the bastions of universities for the very few that will be able to understand categories. So the act and art of writing.
You articulated a large part of it. It partly was motivated by my experience when I was in the White House as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. And I very clearly saw the limits of what you can do inside government. And I came to the view that there are some things that are very important to me to get done. It won't be able to do that unless there are strong civil society group, large bodies of people supporting it. I mean, that's what democracy is about. And it's trying to get greater engagement on these ideas. I have to say there's another factor, which is I enjoy writing. It's a lot of work, but sitting down and trying to put on paper your ideas and fine-hone them and then polish them is something that gives me a lot of pleasure. So I don't want to deny the fact that I find the process enjoyable as well.
There are two books in one here. You kind of get a two for the price of one, the old international bestseller and the new one. And I wonder if at any point the idea of writing a book exclusively on Trump and exclusively on his anti-globalization policies crossed your mind, but you also thought that this 2002 book, Globalization and Its Discontents, needed and merited a revision and an updating. Was this trying to bring the two together?
For a number of years, I had wanted to write a follow-on to Globalization and Its Discontents for two reasons. One, I wanted to try to understand better why that book had as much influence. You know, it sold well over a million copies, translated into well over 35 languages. It really changed the nature of the debate about globalization. It gave many people in emerging markets and developing countries a new confidence about their view of the world. They had always thought that there were the problems that I had identified, but they didn't have the confidence to put those ideas forward. And now they could go into the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and assert them and say, you know, these are not just my views, but a respected economist agrees with me. So it changed the global dialogue, and I wanted to reflect on why it was the book had had the influence that it did. I mean, obviously, when I wrote the book, I had hoped to have some influence, but I did not foresee the magnitude of the impact. At the same time, after 2002, maybe partly because of the book, globalization was changing. The IMF changed its policies. One of my successors as chief economist of the World Bank, Kaushik Basu, once introduced me and saying, you know, my greatest achievement as chief economist of the World Bank was to change the IMF. But these institutions are living institutions and they have changed. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how they have changed, why they have changed, and what the implications of that were. So that was an idea that I'd had for some time. When Trump came along, he redefined the debate about globalization. All of a sudden, there was a kind of nastiness to that whole debate that there hadn't been before. We were trying to fine-tune it, and what he said was wrong, so desperately wrong. As you said before, I wanted to reach out to my fellow citizens and say, you know, you have to understand there are some merits in his complaints that things are not working well for large parts of America. But his explanation of what has gone wrong and his solutions are going to make things worse. And so anybody who cares about the people who have suffered so much, we have to make sure that he doesn't succeed. At the same time, we have to create another globalization. We can't go back to globalization as it was. We can't let protectionism, nativism, isolationism prevail. And we have to construct a new globalization. And that was what really motivated this book.
We're coming to the end of this conversation, Professor Stiglitz, and I want to circle back to the very beginning. After all the things that you have said in the presentation of him reshaping the debate and putting in question essential values that we have, is there anything good that has come or will come from Trump and his ideas, in your view?
Overall, I say no. Overall, I would say that the cost both to the country and to the world of his divisiveness, of his undermining democratic institutions, undermining what I mentioned before, our epistemology, our truth-telling, our understanding of what is the basis of our society. It's been profound, and it's dangerous. You know, when you propagate fascist ideas, there's going to be some groups in society that get a hold of them, and that there are other groups in societies that want to take advantage of those for whom that this group is responding to those ideas. I think all of this is extraordinarily dangerous. So overall, I think it has been an unambiguous disaster. I think there's a rethinking of progressivism. How do we as a society come together to address when there are some really serious problems that we ignored? So there are some positive, you might say, benefits that have come. I think we could have gotten those positive benefits without the ugliness and the divisiveness that Trump has brought to the table. I have a lot of confidence in America, and I don't think we needed that kind of ugliness for us to try to resolve to address the serious problems we have of inequality and the other problems of social justice that we have to confront.
Professor Stiglitz, it's been an honor and a pleasure and an enlightening opportunity to spend this time with you. Thank you for coming to In
Thank
Contrast.
You.
Globalism is an attitude, a disposition. It is about living in the here and now, about stressing the local elements that define our life, while also connecting ourselves with larger elements that exist beyond our confines. The 18th century French philosophers, who are the fathers of the European Enlightenment, were promoters of this view. They championed an attitude that pushed Europe to look at other cultures in order to understand itself. In doing that looking, Europe became global, so to speak. It recognized its own limitations. Of course, the Enlightenment was a double-edged sword. The cosmopolitanism it embraced was reductionistic. It interpreted anything and everything it encountered in the European mold, as if the center of the world was only the so-called old continent. We haven't quite overcome these limitations. Ours is an epoch in which globalism is being sharply criticized by populist leaders and their cohorts. The argument is that in paying attention to things that aren't in front of ourselves, we have forgotten our immediate surroundings. There is truth to this position. Such has been the infatuation with global consumerism of the last few decades that the promise of a better life for everyone has become a mirage. Instead of that, poverty has been reconfigured, with the industrialized nations now being inhabited by it, as well as a result of an uneven immigration to which they haven't planned with enough care. But the clock can no longer be turned back on globalism. The attitude, the disposition of connecting the local with the universal, is ingrained in our civilization. What needs to be done by means of economic, education, and health programs is to even out the imbalance. Immigration will only increase in the years to come, and with it, a number of cultural accommodations. Borders will always remain, but they will become more porous. Yes, the discontents of globalism need to be addressed, but not by closing minds. What we need is a more humbled openness, the recognition that cosmopolitanism isn't a panacea, yet it is better than hyper-nationalism. I am fond of a passage in the extraordinary novel 2666 by Roberto Bolaño, which is about many things, but essentially about one. In the age of instant travel and communication, who are we? The passage reads like this. Did Jesus Christ, he asked, suspect that someday his church would spread to the farthest corners of earth? Did Jesus Christ ever have what we today call an idea of the world? Did Jesus Christ, who apparently knew everything, know that the world was round? And to the east lived the Chinese, and to the west the primitive peoples of America? And he answered himself, no. Although, of course, in a way, having an idea of the world is easy. Everybody has one. Generally, an idea restricted to one's village, bound to the land, to the tangible, in mediocre things before one's eyes. And this idea of the world, petty, limited, crusted with the grime of the familiar, tends to persist and acquire authority and eloquence with the passage of time. I love this quote. The idea of the world we have is always restricted. It is always changing. Our ancestors couldn't have imagined the way that idea would change, just like we can't imagine the idea of the world our successors will have. What is clear, though, is that that idea is always limited. Yet we want and need more because we are restless, because we seek connections, and because we want to understand who we are and who others are. Globalism is the medicine, not the illness. Next time on In Contrast.
So I don't know that one should be tempted to think that we live in a world where we are tolerant of each other and somehow we have fallen from it. I think there is a constant danger.
Amartya Sen on the next In Contrast. Help spread the word about In Contrast by reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. For previous episodes, including our interviews with commentator George Will, our series on the media with Ray Suarez, and an examination of Russia Today with Masha Gessen, visit our website at nepr.net. Our intern is Delaina Hadgu. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.